You're listening to the podcast of the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies. My name is Anja Krieger. In Bonn, Germany, the second week of the United Nations Climate Change Conference has kicked off, and I'm here with Patrick Toussaint, who's writing a PhD on climate justice. Patrick, what is climate justice about?
Climate justice has a lot of different dimensions. One aspect is to what extent people who have least contributed to the problem of climate change are affected by its impacts. Often you have poor and marginalized communities in developing, but also in developed countries, who bear the brunt of extreme weather events, be they hurricanes, be they sea level surges. But you also have slow onset events from climate change, such as sea level rise, droughts, and desertification. And the question is, to what extent can people who are most affected actually influence decision-making on these issues?
So you're really working on climate injustice, is that correct?
Yeah, that's certainly one way to see it. And one way it comes to bear is if you look at court cases. We've had a number of court cases arising in the context of climate justice. Just to name a few examples, we had a case in 2015 brought in the Netherlands by the NGO Urgenda, which was successful in first instance, which basically the court decided that the Dutch government had to increase its greenhouse gas emission reduction target.
And who sued?
Oh, it was a citizens alliance, I would say, of around 800 people, supported by the NGO Urgenda, that brought this case forward. And we see very similar developments in other countries. In Belgium, you have cases brought. In Germany also, quite a different development. You have the NGO German Watch supporting a Peruvian farmer, bringing a case against a German energy company, trying to hold them accountable for impacts in the Peruvian region.
Mm-hmm. What is the situation of this farmer in Peru, and then why is he suing?
All right. It's quite a special case from a legal perspective. It's an experiment, if you will. So you have a Peruvian farmer who lives in a village at the bottom of a mountain. And up in the mountain, there is a glacial lake that is building up due to melting glaciers. And the NGO is arguing on his behalf that the company RWE, due to its contribution to global greenhouse gas emissions, bears a responsibility for the risk of this glacial lake breaking the dam and flooding Saul's village. Now, it's interesting from a legal perspective because, in essence, it's about tort law. Tort law deals with nuisances. Nuisances can be smells, odors, other forms of pollution that come, for example, from an industrial activity. And usually this is confined to the German jurisdiction. But now you have this application of German law extraterritorially to the situation of a farmer in Peru, which is quite extraordinary. And I think cases like Saul versus AVE have the potential to inspire similar actions being brought in other countries.
I also heard that the plaintiffs are often children. Is that right?
That is correct. There's been a case in the US called brought by the NGO Our Children's Trust. I believe it's also been quite successful in first instance. And I think one of the reasons why children are increasingly becoming aware of this issue or increasingly bringing this issue forward is because there's a recognition that future generations will be strongly affected by climate impacts. Now, in my research, I don't specifically deal with the rights and obligations towards future generations, but I look at who is currently affected by climate impacts. And what I've been finding, for example, here in Bonn, I'm conducting a number of expert interviews, trying to understand to what extent affected and vulnerable communities can actually participate in the decision-making here in the climate negotiations.
And then what did you find out? Do you have any preliminary conclusions?
Yes, I do. And the outlook is rather bleak. If you are affected and you do want to participate in this process, you would usually have to be registered with an NGO, a civil society organization that allows you to have access here to the negotiations. But even some meetings that were intended to be open to civil society organizations as observers were at last minute decided to be closed. So in effect, it's very difficult to find instances of effective participation. Often you have stakeholder dialogues coming together where observers can bring their views to the table, but often this just comes in the forms of statements being read out and is not an effective dialogue as such. There is an understanding that the negotiations are still mainly a party-driven process, meaning that countries have the primary say in how decisions are made on the various issues under discussion here.
Who are the vulnerable people? Can we clearly define that?
There are different ways to define who is actually affected by this problem and who's most affected. There's one way to look at it in terms of geography. There are a lot of people that live in areas that are more prone to natural disasters resulting from climate change, whether it's countries affected by hurricanes or by droughts or desertification. And that is probably one of the dominant approaches that is being used here in the negotiations. But another aspect is the social dimension, because it is often, as we find, poor and marginalized communities that are affected the strongest by climate impacts. And as we know, these communities exist both in developed and developing countries. So what I put forward is that if you use this community framing, there's a chance to create more political will both in developed and developing countries around these issues. Currently, the negotiations on what happens to those most affected by climate change are addressed under this issue called loss and damage. Loss and damage essentially describes deaths, injuries, loss and damage to property caused by climate impacts. Some of it may be reversible, some of it may not. There are also non-economic losses and damages, such as loss of cultures, loss of traditions, loss of language, etc. And there are different strategies to dealing with this issue here in the negotiations. Developed countries are advocating strongly for the use of insurance mechanisms to protect basically the poor from these impacts, whereas a lot of small island countries, for example, push for more effective finance to help them protect against these kinds of impacts.
So what do you expect will come out of these court cases? Will it be mostly about money and compensation?
Certainly, money is just one component. As you know, climate impacts are already happening. There are people around the world dying from especially natural disasters related to climate change. And money won't help them. I think one of the functions of these court cases is to bring more attention to this highly important issue, to get more political support also behind taking stronger action to combat climate change in terms of reducing emissions, pushing forward towards the phase-out of fossil fuels. And the other one is, of course, investing more strongly in adaptation, helping people who do not have the possibility to move out of the front line of these climate impacts to be better prepared when disasters strike. One of the ways that is being advocated in the discussions here is insurance. But, of course, there are impacts that you cannot insure to. I mean, if you lose cultures, if you lose traditions, if you lose traditional knowledge and practices to rising sea levels over time, then insurance is not going to help you. So we also need effective strategies to deal with environmental displacement, as it's called, specifically in the Pacific region and other island communities.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Thank you, Anya.